listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. This week, a breath of fresh air for retail as we turn our attention to the United States and a unique offering in a sector that certainly needs some inspiration and innovative thinking. Matt Alexander is the CEO and co-founder of Neighborhood Goods, a brand billed as a modern approach to the department store. The company is based in Texas, where they opened their first outpost in the city of Plano in late 2018. And in just 2 years, they've also opened locations in Chelsea and New York City and in Austin, Texas. Neighborhood Goods is about both discovery and experience. They showcase an ever-changing range of brands in a way that's ideal for both shop and designer. For smaller brands, it gives them a space to present a carefully curated selection of their range in a physical space. And for Neighborhood Goods, it offers their customers an ever-evolving space to learn about new and interesting companies. Networking through live events, in their space, and food and drink, also part of the experience, with in-house restaurant and bar concepts called Prim and Proper and Tiny Feast. During lockdown in the past few months, Matt and the team have turned their attention to finding a new way to tell stories and to give a boost to the brands they work with. They launched something called The Commons, a free platform they curate where designers, artists, and musicians, and brands in food and drink, homewares, and fashion can engage with customers. It's like an online community hub for storytelling. To hear the full story of Neighborhood Goods, I called up Matt, who spoke to me from Dallas.
Yeah, so born and raised in the UK. My mum's American, my dad's English, so dual citizen. Ended up coming over here for university. A few years out, I'd started one company, which was acquired back in 2016, relatively small sort of project. But while I was sort of developing that, of particular note was a not-for-profit initiative called Unbranded, which started back in 2014 or thereabouts, where we created a platform to provide free retail and event space to independent entrepreneurs, artists, chefs, things of that nature every holiday season for the most part. And so we did it here in Dallas, and it was really just born out of a desire to sort of experiment more in the physical space between myself and a guy called Brian DeLuca, who was running a company called Foot Cardigan at the time. We did that just as a slapdash experiment, this sort of idea to opening sort of within 3 or 4 weeks. And at the time, no one really knew what pop-ups were here and otherwise. And so we sort of ran along with this notion of, well, hey, if you create a relevant sort of communally centric sort of concept, it can be really sort of exciting for the consumer. It can be really meaningful for entrepreneurs, brands, otherwise. And so we did it in relatively unorthodox in an unorthodox area for the first time. And then it was taken on by a local nonprofit called Downtown Dallas Inc., which works very closely with the city. And they've done it every year since. And it's become this really meaningful thing for people to sort of tap into those communities that build around their brands, regardless of their size. And so what was interesting was that we opened up applications and had brands come in from all over the country when we first launched it. And we just did it for free. There was never any intention to make money from it. But over the years, it certainly got a lot more attention than anything else I'd been sort of working on for the most part. And so back in early 2017, I was approached by a guy called Mark Macinta, who's prominent in the sort of retail real estate space. And he had sort of been aware of me for my company, but in particular for Unbranded for a few years, and reached out and just said, you know, he was working on a development in Plano, Texas, just north of Dallas. And they were developing a food hall at one end of it. And he was feeling that there needed to be something similar spiritually at the opposite end of the development to sort of bookend it. And so he was interested in seeing if there was a permanent version of Unbranded that might be able to come into existence at the development. And so we met up for lunch and ended up chatting for hours. And he just felt strongly that something in that space needed to exist. I sort of felt strongly that there was a slightly different way of doing it than what we've been doing with Unbranded, which its integrity and strength was doing something very much for free for smaller brands. But I felt that there was something more robust and potentially profitable that could be developed at scale for all sorts of different brands in all sorts of different areas. And so that became the basis for the idea. And so Mark's firm based here in Dallas, they've done a lot of the retail real estate for, you know, pretty much every Apple store, certainly in the US, Warby, Tesla, many others that they've worked with over the years. And so just really sort of fantastic group. And so it became this really nice little partnership where he felt strongly there was an opportunity and just wanted to help facilitate it coming into existence. And I had had some experience there and felt strongly about where we could go with it. And so We started running along with this idea of developing what I decided to describe as being a new type of department store, just in as much as I wanted to find a really succinct way of trying to set expectations for what the experience would look like. Because as soon as you start invoking words like pop-ups, people picture sort of more temporary, sort of slightly lesser sort of interpretations of a given brand or retail experience. So certainly that was the case at the time. It's become quite different these days. And started running along with that concept. And I think the company was incorporated in August 2017 or thereabouts. And I ran along as the only employee until July 2018 or thereabouts, building it out. And then we opened our first location in November 2018, and we've gone along from there.
You've got a couple of other locations I'd love to come on to. Obviously, that plays into our current situation in the pandemic and how things are going there. But just to sort of continue on the storyline, it'd be interesting to hear a little bit about the actual space and how you've used that to sort of boost brands. It's interesting, you say, you know, how you came into this and how you were sort of there to help grow brands and get them some attention. But essentially now you've become a stockist curating for different people. There's brands that people will recognize, of course, but talk to me a little bit about how that works in a physical space.
Yeah, so the department store analogy is good to an extent, but it's relatively inaccurate. But yeah. In terms of where it is accurate, it's, you know, we're creating fixed physical spaces. It's our staff, it's our aesthetic, it's our fixtures. We have our own restaurants inside the spaces. And so you go in and it's one cohesive, consistent experience that speaks to most major product categories. But beyond that, the spaces are typically much smaller than a traditional department store. So our spaces are typically hovering on average around 10,000 square feet, whereas a traditional department store would be sort of upward of 100,000. And we don't stock just anyone and everyone. It's much more selective. And then each of our locations feature a different mix of brands and products within some of those brands that do overlap between multiple locations to befit the given market in which we are a part. So we want them to be, above all else, trading in a currency of relevance where we can be really focused on a given area. And so initially, the core sort of basis for the idea, beyond the notion of creating more sort of communal retail where you could sort of help brands do pop-ups without having to staff them and build them themselves, was this recognition that customer acquisition cost online has been going progressively upward over the years. As more brands have come to the table, they've been able to raise capital, and they're all pursuing the same demographic of customers. And so it's becoming much more expensive. And then meanwhile, because there's so much more competition in the space, it's becoming that much more difficult for them to maintain loyalty of customers. And so physical retail was seen as a solution in as much as it allows for you to be just sort of passively present in a location that might be within a certain proximity of your ideal sort of consumer. And so they tend to have a little bit more loyalty to you, and they tend to sort of be less expensive to maintain and or acquire in the first place. And so physical retail for a lot of these digital brands started to make a huge amount of sense. But as we all know, physical retail's expensive and cumbersome, and it's a very traditional industry, and people don't want to sign 10-year leases and sort of deal with negotiating various different sort of lease structures and otherwise. And so the notion of lowering the barrier to entry made a lot of sense. You know, a lot of them were hosting pop-ups, but they would spend hundreds of thousands to do them for a very short period of time and not necessarily generate that much of a return beyond just the brand equity of the thing. And so the notion of creating something that could lower the barrier to entry, both in terms of the operational aspect and the financial aspect, as well as creating something that could be elevating in terms of the curation and mix, really resonated with people, whether they were investors or brands. And so we set out with the intention. So our first location in Plano, Texas, about 14,000 feet. We put a restaurant right in the middle. And then we sort of designed sort of a grid into the space where we assumed we'd have 10 to 15 brands. They'd have anywhere from 100 to 500 square feet. And it'd be predominantly this direct consumer crowd. What we ended up with when we launched was about 25 to 30 brands. And it spanned from, you know, some of those high growth upstarts to much more traditional brands as well. And so we launched with Stadium Goods, Buck Mason, Hims, and Draper James, and a number of others. And we sort of ticked a lot of different boxes for people. And it just did really well from the beginning and sort of clearly really resonated with people. We got a lot wrong and had to sort of find our way from there. But what we quickly found was that the presumption that brands needed, you know, 100 to 500 square feet was quite wrong. And we also discovered that it wasn't just direct to consumer digitally native brands that would want this sort of thing. And so now, you know, we have three locations and we can get into sort of more of the strategy and thought there, but you know, we now work with brands like Aesop, Entire World, Laleen. We've brought in brands to do their first ever physical. We do a lot with brands like Tashin. We've brought brands from Europe to the US for the first time. And we also serve as a platform increasingly for brands that have been heavily affected by COVID and just generally trying to get off the ground. And so, you know, the moral of the story being that neighborhood goods is a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but to the consumer, the core experience is what feels like a very edited and very relevant sort of almost boutique-like experience that just happens to change quite frequently with brands you would otherwise not find in physical retail. And, you know, we're online and we have lots of other bits and pieces as well, but it's always been for us this balance of the art and science of the industry, and the art is the thing that we would prefer to be known for, and that's certainly what we hope you experience when you come in.
That's really interesting, because the way you started to explain it there, it sounded like you have a bunch of brands that would be direct to consumer and have an online retail only presence, and then go through you obviously to get a little bit of that physical footprint. Sounds like a great trade-off, but it's much more than that, I think, in the way that you're talking about how you choose to work with these different brands. And what you've done actually through coronavirus, I think, is a further extension of that. Tell me about the commons, because that sort of goes back to where you started, right? Another way to sort of boost brands.
Yeah, the commons is it's essentially unbranded, you know, the basis for this cool concept, where we on March 14th, closed all three of our stores to sort of get ahead of the world starting to sort of fall apart a little bit and to do right by our teams and so on and so forth. And within a few weeks of that, we had been doing everything we could to sort of overhaul our website, which had been active. We've had an app and we've always been online and shoppable there. But obviously with that being the focus for an indefinite amount of time, we really doubled down. But we really started to think about how could this be a big opportunity for us as a company? You know, both thinking about COVID sort of serving as an accelerant for a lot of what was already happening in the retail industry in general. So in the US, we've seen a lot of larger department stores go into bankruptcy and many are stumbling, and there's been brands that have been stumbling. And these are things that were happening already and were going to happen at some point in the next 24 months regardless. And so it's just moved it a lot faster. And so we started to look at that. And then we also started to look at the general sort of prevailing thought that, you know, the pandemic isn't going anywhere. You know, we can get better about how to live with it and the better sort of day-to-day etiquette to preserve safety and be more thoughtful about it. But it's not going anywhere for the foreseeable future. And so we started to think about A, how we could sort of take advantage of the situation to sort of build some momentum around our concept and our particular take on the industry, where a lot of traditional brands that rely quite heavily on department stores and wholesale might be sort of a little bit disillusioned by those partnerships, where landlords might be looking at more sort of nuanced and more progressive models that sort of work a little bit differently. And then where consumers might be a little bit more thoughtful about why they're leaving their house in the first place and what is the magnetism and reason for them to go into a shopping development in the first place or into a shop in general. And so, you know, for us, we had always recognized that we're not going to be a great sort of vehicle for the utility of buying something really reliably. We're much more experts in discovery, and experts is generous. And so, you know, it's much more that you want to come in to find something new, to touch and feel something you've seen online, to really sort of come to have a little bit more of a relationship. And you don't have to shop right then and there, but it's more about that sort of feeling of discovery and that feeling of relevance. And so we started to think about, well, how can we start really focusing on that in this time? Like, lots of brands probably aren't going to be signing leases. Others are going to be really struggling. How can we bring people together in a way that can be supportive of our respective communities? And so we hatched this idea for the commons that allowed our team something really positive to align around, to build towards, and for our spaces to become really important aspects of utility for them as we sort of reopen. And so the basics is that we decided to provide free space to brands that had lost meaningful sales and performance during the pandemic. And so that's brands that may have lost big wholesale orders. It's brands that might be much younger and didn't have much in the way of an advertising budget or a growth plan, but a really great product. And it was just completely cut off when they lost their supply chain or they lost their core customer, which might have been a smaller base than others. And so we just started to look at, all right, well, how do we be supportive of these brands? How do we bring them into these different spaces so it can speak to these respective communities? And how can we take it beyond just the retail aspect? So we have restaurants in each of our spaces? How can we open up the kitchens to support restaurateurs that may have lost their spaces? How can we open it up to musicians? How can we open it up to artists? And so we just opened up applications. And so it went from idea to active on our site and receiving applications within a week. And we've launched it in our location since we reopened. We reopened in Texas in early June, and we launched with about 15 brands in each of our locations there. And we're basically running a month at a time with a different sort of class or cohort of these brands. And it's increasing over time as we sort of get more of our sea legs in this environment. So our second class just launched with 28 brands, and it's expanded now to New York since we've reopened there. And the intention is to run it for, at a minimum, as long as we were closed, which in Texas was just under 90 days, and New York probably close to 120. And so, you know, we're going to see what we can do to be supportive. And we found it, you know, to be very sort of productive and really interesting so far. Customers have really taken to these brands. We've seen a lot of the brands that were in our first class asked to remain with us as more sort of in a more traditional relationship. And so we see it as something that we can continue to sort of try to support in the future and sort of try to be, you know, a meaningful asset for some of these brands that are trying to get back on their feet.
Well, that's interesting. I wanted to ask you about how that works sort of moving forward, because it sounds like the model that you had created before all this pandemic and before people weren't able to physically come in and discover brands was sort of a way to combat the decline of retail that you set out. It's a different way to discover brands. So talk to me about how that has changed your thinking now as you reopen these stores, and you've got a brand new one in Austin as well. You've just opened so a couple of months ago. So how does that sort of play into, you know, the next couple of months, the next year, and moving forward?
Yeah, so the core of it in brief is that we charge brands typically a fixed fee to be in the stores per month. Some brands, they just pay a fee and they make 100% of what they sell. Others pay a lesser fee and we take a percentage of sales. And that remains the case with the commons. We just take a tiny, tiny percentage of sales. So what would normally be a more significant or balanced amount that's on a relatively distinct basis from one brand to the next, with these brands, is more like us taking, you know, 5% or less and charging nothing else. So it covers a bare minimum of our expenses, but, you know, funnels the vast majority of revenue right to the brands. And so, you know, the core of our model is in recognition of the fact that, you know, as we discussed earlier, that brands don't necessarily want to be in physical retail or inside neighborhood goods just for sales. You know, for some of them, it's about marketing, customer acquisition. Others, it's about assessing a new market ahead of, you know, a more robust expansion and opening of their own store, perhaps in one of those areas. For some, it's about product testing. For some, it's about brand adjacency, very traditional, right? And so the model we have is essentially consignment from a product perspective. So brands ship us a relatively small amount of product, which we then sell, and we remit payment back to the brand net of any sort of fees or otherwise on a regular basis. And that way, if they are running a big promotion on their own sites or otherwise, they can just quickly get the product back. For us, if something's quickly selling out, we can bring it back in. But it reduces the sort of general tension around having to run sales, and it means that we can be just very nimble in terms of our assortment. And then the brands aren't locked into any terms with us. So if they want to leave ahead of the schedule, they can just sort of let us know and we'll find a way out. If they want to extend, they can do that as well. And so it's just a very, very fluid and sort of simple relationship. And then we provide now, or are about to start providing, real-time data to them as well. So they get real-time traffic, demographics, sales, and otherwise. So it becomes this very sort of active new sales and sort of data channel for them to really sort of learn a lot more. And so that model all remains very much the same. It's very relevant in this environment where it's more efficient and profitable than wholesale for the brands. It also means that there's no tension around sort of discounting their product, which would undercut their general integrity as a brand. It also means that for us, we're not burdened with a huge amount of product and in real sort of trouble there. And so it just works in a much more holistic way. The one thing that we're really sort of shifting around is that in 2019, we worked with just over 100 brands throughout the year. And for the most part for that year, we really just had one location, with New York opening right at the end. We ended the year with just under 90 of them still active with us, which is not how the model was meant to work at all, where we were expecting much more sort of brands to be with us for, you know, 3 months to 6 months on average. And we ended up with them becoming much more sort of loyal to the ecosystem than we would have anticipated. And that's not to say there hasn't been change, but we've also seen brands leave and then come back in a different format or move to a different location and otherwise. And so what we've sort of started to adapt around is this idea that the stores can have a little bit more in terms of brands in each location, which accordingly reduces the amount of fee that they would have to spend to be in the space. And we can have a more edited assortment within each of those brands. It's also yielding really interesting conversations around collaborations, both between the brands themselves inside our walls, but also between us and the brands. So we rolled out our own private label back in December, which was really well received and has taken on a life of its own, where we're starting to do a lot of collaborations and exclusives. And then, you know, between our brands, we start to notice patterns and in the data that otherwise wouldn't be intuitive or obvious to the brands, where you can find a link between kids' products and a streetwear brand, for argument's sake, where you can see young parents essentially buying a pair of Yeezys and then buying a onesie on the other side of the room, which just sort of opens up a lot of interesting opportunity for collaboration that would have otherwise not been obvious or intuitive. And so, you know, where we head from here, the model remains very much the same. It's just in this environment, right? The paradox of things is that the basis for us to exist is that customer acquisition cost was going so significantly upward online. Right now, it's lower than ever. And so hypothetically, brands could run really efficient advertising campaigns and find real growth for at least the foreseeable future until the economy sort of really rebounds. But the trouble is that most of them are on really sort of tight budgets, and advertising is often the first thing to go. And so they're not advertising a huge amount right now, and they're certainly not signing long-term leases. And so if we can lower that barrier to entry and become an efficient sort of customer acquisition channel, as well as unlocking things like same day local delivery in really critical markets and in-store pickup, and generally sort of aligning them with really sort of positive and uplifting brands, it has a lot of utility for people. And so we're just wanting to lean into that. And that's not to say that we want to sort of flood our stores with products or brands. It's very much sort of where we are right now, which is sort of about 50 to 60 brands per location and fluctuates upward and downward from there. So we'll remain roughly there, but it's just more that we can sort of start dabbling more with, you know, brands that I've mentioned, like Aesop, in balance with, you know, younger brands like Dollar Shave Club that are getting into physical for the first time. And so we can sort of play a little bit more with that balance, where some of these larger names that might be doing very well in this environment can sort of subsidize brands that might come into the commons or otherwise. And so we're trying to build this balanced ecosystem around all of it and see what we can do to sort of, in as much as we can, take advantage of the general situation at the moment.
Well, it sounds like you might be getting a few emails and calls from smaller brands that are chasing stockists right now to pay invoices, where your model might be slightly more appealing. Talk to me about a little bit about what you're thinking about these days, this week, as obviously there's so much uncertainty on, you know, how many people you'll be able to get actually out to physical locations. Obviously, you've got the name Neighborhood Goods. It's about community. It's about getting people together. So what are you thinking about in those terms?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you mentioned, we had just opened our third location in Austin, and we opened it, and it was open for less than 24 hours before we closed all of our stores. And one of the last things we did to get it ready to open was put up a bio about what Neighborhood Goods is on the wall near one of the entrances. And it talks about being a place for where people can gather. And of course, that's not what we want to happen at the moment. And, you know, the basis for us to close at the time was that we were seeing the data just like everyone else that morning. So we were meant to launch on March 13th, which we did, which was meant to be the first day of South by Southwest in Austin. It was cancelled, obviously. And we had a lot of events in the pipeline with groups like Soho House and a number of others who are gearing up to open their first location in Texas. And we had lots in the pipeline for that week. And obviously, we'd sort of scaled it back. And the marketing had sort of become basically sort of just an acknowledgement that we were there, but no real ask for you to show up. And I don't even think we sent an email on the day. But nonetheless, we were still seeing quite meaningful sales in New York and Plano. Meanwhile, we saw quite a few people show up in Austin and start shopping just organically, even though we had done very little. And normally that would be a great sign that we, for a retailer, that, you know, things are just organically working. But in this sort of environment, it's much more concerning. And so we decided to close. And, you know, in the aftermath, you know, we made a lot of tough calls. We had to ultimately do some furloughs, some layoffs, some pay reductions and cuts. And so we've certainly not been spared some of the more negative things that come with this. And obviously now we're facing many, many, many difficult questions as we look ahead, just purely born out of uncertainty. You know, there's a huge amount coming up in the US in the fall that sort of makes for a very uncertain time between the pandemic and the election and myriad other topics, right? And so for us, what we're trying to do is just sort of be good citizens, right? So we closed very promptly when things got worse here, and we got a lot of kudos from our brands there. We didn't charge any of our brands while we were closed. And, you know, in the time since, we've reopened and we expected to lose a lot more of our brands, and we didn't. We've kept all of them, and then we added a lot more through the commons, and then a lot of our bigger brands are now sort of extending with us. And what we found in Texas so far is lower traffic, but very high conversion rate. And so the stores are sort of drastically outperforming what we would have expected, but, you know, still further to go. New York, we just reopened, so it's too soon to tell. But, you know, the moral of the story is that we're open. We've kept the restaurants mostly closed so that we can sort of maintain an environment in which masks can be worn 100% of the time and are required to be, amongst all sorts of other health and safety mechanisms. And that's really all we can do. You know, it seems that the sort of current conversation is focused on environments where you cannot wear a mask 100% of the time. So various entertainment, restaurants, you know, concerts, things like that. Our environment seems to be on the spectrum of risk, relatively low, but certainly not without risk. And so we're trying to be as thoughtful and cautious as we can be. But, you know, where we are psychologically is absolutely prepared to close again if we have to. And the expectation is that it would be less of closing all three and more closing sort of one or two selectively at any given time. We saw our digital side of our business grow radically while we were closed, and it's maintained its momentum since. And so the ecosystem is working as it should. And this aspect of sort of local logistics for these brands has become an unexpected aspect of, you know, real value as part of our typical conversation. And so where we are now is sort of a feeling of cautious optimism. You know, I think we're seeing cases declining in Texas after sort of rising for a bit. In New York, we're reopened. The stores are doing better than expected, and our brands are largely sticking with us and doing really interesting things. And our pipeline is really full at the moment with some really interesting brands that we would have never expected to hear from before. So for the foreseeable future, you know, we're sort of looking at things sort of very day by day. You know, it could be one day that things take a real turn and we have to make, you know, really tough calls again. But otherwise, you know, we're sort of continuing to move forward on a basis where we're sort of looking at what we can do opportunistically in this sort of environment. And so we're starting increasingly to think less about playing defense and what can we do more in terms of more of an offensive action as we go into next year, where, you know, not many people are going to be signing leases at the moment. So maybe we should be thinking about signing some more leases, taking advantage of the current climate so that as and when treatment and or vaccine becomes a little bit more of a reality, whenever that may be, we might have more of a footprint that's relevant for brands in areas that's still relevant, regardless of the current sort of climate. And so we're very much looking at more expansion right now. We're sort of doubling down on more of our private label, which has been doing so well, and just continuing to focus on what more we can do to enhance the positives in each of our locations and diminish the negatives. And so fortunately right now it's mostly positives, but as I say, I mean, for us and many, many, many others, there's big questions. But, you know, we, by complete fluke, by no design, we had raised a round of capital towards the end of last year, which puts us in a good sort of long-term position as long as we are good stewards of that capital and continue to focus on more classic ideas of business around profitability and sustainability in as much as we can. And so that's where we've sort of find ourselves. It's sort of, it changes by the day, but increasingly just, I would tell you, as of just the past few days, now that all of the stores are open, digital continues to perform well, we find ourselves very much in a position where we're not ignoring the realities, which are very concerning socioeconomically speaking, and in terms of the just general health climate looking ahead. But we're starting to look at things and sort of trying to think more about what our role is on the other side of all of this and how we can sort of really start to build towards that, which is exciting. Just the same way we needed the commons as something for our team to align around during a very fraught time in sort of March, April. Now we're starting to look not at such a short period, but now looking sort of 6 to 9 to 12 months ahead, and what are we all spending our time doing and really sort of focusing on beyond the obvious in terms of trying to do well by our brands. And so that's roughly where we fall. I mean, it's a very sort of, you could read it a lot of different ways, but I mean, I would tell you it's more cautiously optimistic than anything else.
Well, very well said. And I do enjoy your optimism, Matt, and offensive strategy. I do hope it works out well for you. And I appreciate your time. This has been really interesting.
Thank you so much.
Matt Alexander there, CEO and co-founder of Neighborhood Goods, speaking to me from Texas. My thanks to Matt. You can learn more at neighborhoodgoods.com. That's all for this week. My thanks as well to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.